I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
Hi, this is Marion Bartoli.
I'm Mats Wilander.
This is Mary Carrillo.
I'm Stan Wawrinka.
I'm Leighton Hewitt.
I'm Andy Murray.
This is Yannick Noah, and you're listening to the Tennis Podcast.
Hello, folks, and welcome to our first daily tennis podcast from the US Open 2020. It's 1 o'clock in the morning, UK time, which means it's 8 p.m. New York time. Matt's nodding at me in appreciation of my nimble mathematics there. Thanks very much, Matt. It is only Matt here to appreciate my nimble mathematics because as we speak at 1 o'clock in the morning, David Law, who, like the trooper that he is, having commentated on five sets of Cameron Norrie against Diego Schwartzman earlier, more of that to come, is now embroiled in a potential further British five-setter between Kyle Edmund and Alexander Bublik, meaning that Matt came up with the interesting suggestion that we record a two-part podcast, both parts featuring Matt Roberts, one part featuring Catherine Whittaker, one part featuring David Law. It's a quite literal mix.
I've become an anchor accidentally.
I said, "Are you sure you're good to go, Matt?" And you said, "I'm as good as I'm ever going to get to go."
Yeah, this
so
is
good
peak
luck
me.
To David with the
part two,
with
Matt.
The second part.
Which might be at about 3 o'clock in the morning, something like that.
We've both been listening to David on the radio, though, and it's peak David Law. I think you're going to get a good David Law for the second part, so stick around for that. David and Matt will wrap up the night session, which features Novak Djokovic, who, as I speak to you, is demolishing Damir Djumhur, but who knows? Stranger things have happened. Maybe you'll be talking in 5 hours' time about a Damir Djumhur fight back, Matt. Matt's face
doesn't seem to be
expressing particular enthusiasm for that scenario. And Naomi Osaka also plays under the lights on Ash against Misaki Doi. And of course, they will round up the developing thriller between Kyle Edmund and the extremely fun Alexander Bublik. I'll leave that to David to describe all the ways in which he's fun, because there are many. But the reason that Kyle Edmund, the third match of the day on court number 5, is still ongoing at 1 o'clock in the morning UK time is because Cameron Norrie and 9th seed Diego Schwartzman took 400 hours earlier, Matt, to complete their first round match, a match that featured more break points than have ever been featured in any match in US Open history. And it really, really felt like it, didn't it?
It was one of those matches where if you were to just give the headlines, you would think it had been a classic. There were more break points than there's ever been, back and forth. Result in the balance right until the end. It wasn't a classic. Despite all of that, the quality of tennis was quite low, I felt, unfortunately. And I think Cameron Norrie did a very good job to hang in there. He was two sets down. This is the second time in his career he's come back from two sets down. The first time was his Davis Cup debut, wasn't it, against Roberto Bautista Agut, a couple of years ago. But Schwartzman's behavior and sort of attitude was really strange. He was quite grumpy, and I don't associate him with being a grumpy person. I'm not sure what happened to him.
It was an extremely bizarre match. I mean, from an Amazon perspective, I was presenting for Prime Video today, as you say, on paper, British player fights back from two sets to love down to win first match of our coverage of the tournament. I mean, the dream, right? It did not feel like a dream. Well, it felt like a bad dream. I mean, I'm so pleased for Cam Norrie and his competitive spirit and all the rest of it. Really impressive. And he's a really likeable chap. But it wasn't an enjoyable watch by any means, and particularly because that was the most bizarre Diego Schwartzman performance I've ever seen. You know, he was ninth seed at this slam. I think that's the first time he's been a top 10 seed at a slam. He had a good run at this tournament last year. That's a horrible result for him today. And there were periods there where I know he had a bit of treatment on his right forearm, didn't he, sort of late on in the match. And he did look physically hampered, but he also looked completely out of steam. As you say, completely frustrated and grumpy and at times unprofessional. And I was quite surprised before the match to read comments from him after the Western and Southern Open saying he really struggled for motivation playing without crowds. And I wonder if that was what was going on today. But I sort of feel like, get over it and get on with it, you know?
Yeah, he's one of those guys, Diego Schwartzman, because he doesn't have a particularly big game, he sort of needs all the parts of his game to be working, and they just weren't. And you know, he sort of relies on consistency, and he was missing massively, and he relies on being faster than his opponent, and he wasn't moving particularly well. And I think a big factor in this tournament could be, in the men's tournament, could be the five sets. I mean, these guys are not conditioned at the moment for five sets tennis. And Diego Schwartzman, to me, looked like he completely ran out of steam in that fifth set. He was barely moving his feet by the end of it. I think that was what got Cameron Norrie over the line. He's played a lot more matches over the lockdown period. Schwartzman, for a while, was stuck in Argentina, not being able to play tennis. He didn't quite look ready for five sets to me. And maybe that was why he was frustrated, because he probably knew that, and he was in a position to win that match in straight sets. And when he didn't finish it off, he probably knew that Cameron Norrie had that kind of physical edge over him. And it all sort of boiled over, and he started having arguments with the umpire. And any little thing he was getting to him, and he was making a big deal out of it. It was a Diego Schwartzman I've never seen before, and I didn't particularly like it. I want old Diego back.
I couldn't agree more. Do you want, Matt, Cam Norrie to now inherit the Arthur Ashe Stadium hospitality box, which are designated to all the seeded players? Should there be a protocol in place? This is a Grand Slam. It's the protocol slam. Should there be a protocol in place, meaning that an exiting seeded player concedes their VIP hospitality suite, which I've seen a tour of by Andy Murray today. It looks very swanky. To the player that beats them.
I think that absolutely should happen. I think it's a great idea, isn't it? I mean, it puts even more on the line of those matches for the unseeded player, a kind of sweet Arthur Ashe sweet roulette or winner stays on type situation. I love it. Obviously, they would need to be deep cleaned and wiped with antibacterial wipes.
That's
after
the bit
the
we don't need to see,
it,
Matt.
But that's fine. That can go on in the 24 hours in between. Yeah, I think it's great, because that was one of the images of the day, wasn't it? A shirtless and slumping and sad Diego Schwartzman
outstaying his welcome in his hospitality suite. Yeah.
Just one last stay watching Alexander Zverev before he concedes his suite to someone else.
Alexander Zverev does not have to concede his suite. There was a moment there where he was, you know, the keys to the suite were on the table, but he does get to keep them. He won the first set on the tiebreak against Kevin Anderson, lost the second and ended up winning through in four, and then having a sort of a virtual moment with his brother courtside after the match. What do we think about the virtual moments, Matt?
I was ready to hate them. But I actually quite liked that moment with his brother. I thought it was actually quite nice.
We're also seeing winners on Arthur Ashe Stadium court still hitting balls into the stands, which at first looked like a bit of a curiosity because obviously the stands are completely empty. But it turns out they've put targets around the top edge of the Arthur Ashe Stadium, and every winning player gets three opportunities to hit a ball at the targets, and should they hit one, then $1,000 is donated to one of the USTA charities. So they're trying, aren't they? They're trying to make it feel... Are they trying to make it feel less weird, or are they trying to embrace the weird and make a feature of it? I guess kind of a bit of both.
I think it's that, isn't it? Yeah, I think it's that. It's quite a simple idea, quite a fun idea, and if they can make a bit of money along the way for a good cause, then I think it's the sort of thing that they should be doing. I've yet to confirm whether anyone has actually hit a target yet.
It's certainly not caused any kind of stir if they have, Matt. It's passed me by if they have.
Totally.
Seeing as I've mentioned weird, should we segue into Stefanos Tsitsipas?
And his press conference, you mean?
And his press conference, because his tennis was brilliant today. He won Albert Ramos Vinolas, which sort of looked like maybe a tricky draw. He just absolutely ate him for breakfast today. So, yeah, sensational tennis, weird press conference.
Yeah, I think when you have a weird press conference, it's often a sign that your match, you didn't need to talk about it. And I think in this instance, it's a positive sign. As you said, he played so well, there was nothing really to talk about the match. It was so straightforward. He was great. Every single question in his press conference was about towels.
He's not exaggerating, folks. There is a transcript. It's on the internet. Every single question. One question is simply, have you got any good towel stories? Have you ever been asked that, Matt?
No. And my mind would freeze
Imagine being put on the spot and having to produce a towel story.
I know. Impossible.
Without warning.
One of my favourite things at Grand Slams is trying to spot the journalist who's got a sort of very specific article to write. I remember at the French Open last year, it was Dustin Brown, and everyone in the draw was being asked about Dustin Brown to get their perspective on it. And obviously at the moment it's towels.
I mean, he was a great target, wasn't he? Because Tsitsipas, a lot of players would just go, oh, why are you asking me about towels? But Tsitsipas sort of really earnestly thought carefully about all of the towel questions, and in fact started, you know, predictably philosophically talking about the significance of towels in his life, which I suppose is very on brand and probably exactly what we should have expected from the first day of the US Open.
And I hope the journalist goes to Kevin Anderson's press conference, because he was doing the most interesting towel thing today, which was sticking it down the back of his shorts so that he had sort of quick, easy access to it, because he sweats a lot.
Apparently that's a throwback thing that they always used to do. And then poor Greg Rozetsky has been credited with inventing the towel movement, hasn't he? I think he refutes that. I probably should put his side of the story across.
I was going to say credited is a choice there. Criticised, yes. Would be another word.
Yeah, exactly. We've lost Coco Gauff to Anastasia Sevastova. That is the match that I was covering before coming off air earlier on today. Difficult to know precisely how much to read into that, because anyone can lose to Anastasia Sevastova, and certainly anybody can do so at the US Open, where she's got this crazy brilliant record. She's quarterfinalist 3 out of the last 4 years, semi-finalist a few years ago, and she can be a joy to watch and also a total frustration to watch. She looks like she's sort of on the edge of breakdown all the time, to Sevastova. And I'm very conscious that when we discuss this, we should always remember that Coco Gauff is 16 years old. But there is just an ever so tiny, and I really do mean tiny, but backwards direction of travel slightly with Coco Gauff. I feel like the double faults needs dealing with, I think, now, before it becomes a Zverev-y type situation. Mm.
Yeah, there were 13 double faults, I believe, today, which is a lot. And I think Pam Shriver tweeted that there's kind of work to be done on that serve in terms of the rhythm of it and the ball toss. And she expressed a bit of surprise, Pam Shriver, that it hadn't been addressed during the sort of lockdown period. I don't think it was a criticism. It was just a surprise. And I think Sevastova kind of said it best in terms of how we should be talking about Coco Gauff. The very first line of Sevastova's press conference was, well, I would love to have played that well at 16 years old, which I just thought was a very neat summary that we shouldn't, you know, we should always keep that in mind with Coco Gauff. I think it's fine, though, to point out things that need addressing. I think there's this strange attitude around Coco Gauff that you can't praise her too much because she's 16 years old, but you can't sort of point things out either because she's 16 years old. I kind of think both things are okay. But yeah, I mean, Sevastova, the weird thing is that, as you said, anyone can lose to her, and yet no one really has been losing to her this year because she'd lost in the first round of 7 straight tournaments this season.
I had no idea she had that horrible a record recently. That had passed me by a little.
Because the big headline Sevastova result of the year was her win over Serena in the Fed Cup. So she's now only got 2 wins this whole year against Serena in Fed Cup and Coco Gauff in the first round of the US Open. Extraordinary. And that was a match where I really missed fans, I must say. I mean, I've missed them all day. Fans make tournaments, make stadiums feel alive. And I was just thinking back to Coco Gauff's run last year where those crowds, that energy was such a big part of it. And to have that missing today could also potentially have been a factor. I think I saw Chris Evert said that she thought Coco Gauff might have won that match if there were fans in the crowd behind her. I think it is going to be affecting some results, and that was one where it just felt like Coco Gauff might have had a little bit more energy or just a higher level down the stretch if she'd had fans as she did last year.
How much more, Matt, have you missed fans today? And it is early days, and my experience prior to the US Open is that I have got used to it and adjusted, and even learnt to appreciate some elements of there being no crowds. But how much more have you felt that loss today compared to the few weeks of non-Grand Slam tennis without fans that we'd seen before today?
I'd say I felt it a lot more keenly today. And I think one of the reasons for that is, as you know, Catherine, when there's so many matches on the first day of a slam, I love it, but I also get a little bit stressed by it.
And it's sort of my favourite and least favourite Matt Roberts all at the same time. He has this, for such a calm, collected man, this sort of slightly wild look in his eye the whole time. It's sort of great and disconcerting.
But one of the tools I usually use in terms of determining what to watch, I have a sort of multi-screen setup and I have the sound on, and you will look up when you hear a big roar and you kind of know that that's a match to go to and follow and something epic is happening. And you just feel a little bit more disconnected, I think, from all the action when there's no fans, because there's just not that natural soundtrack sort of telling you and guiding you where to go and what to watch.
Daniela Hantikova also made the point on air today, which I hadn't really given much time to before today, but it's very interesting perspective from her, that she said, as one of the, obviously this would apply to seeded players more than unseeded players, and certainly the higher profile ones the most, but just being able to walk around freely at a slam, wander around, not worry about having to have security to get from A to B, or whether you can even get from A to B, just obviously in lots of ways their freedoms are restricted, but actually on site at the tennis centre, in a lot of ways their freedoms are greater for there not being fans there. And yeah, that just, she her eyes lit up at it. She said, I would have just loved to be able to walk around that place as it is right now. So that was, I suppose that was one of the, I mean, it was an upset and also not an upset at all. It was more sort of a result that will make headlines rather than an upset. The top seed Pliskova, she won through pretty easily. Annette Kontaveit survived a bit of a scare against Danielle Collins. That's a blooming tough draw for her. Kvitova, she was strong against Arina Camelia Begu. Kerber, David Law's pick for the tournament. I'm not going to get worried about David Law having back to dark horse correctly just yet, but everyone is saying that she was really, really good today, and that annoyed me a little bit, not because I don't like Angelique Kerber, but because it would just annoy me. Sasnovic gave me a bit of a scare. But she won through. Yep, she won the. She lost the first set 6-2, Matt, and I felt a little shaky.
She was match point down in the second set.
Was she?
Yeah, she was match point down.
I'm really glad I didn't know about that at the time. I feel like I've got a lot of credibility riding on her.
I'm really enjoying having company in a sort of crazy yes. prediction world that we're in, because normally you're out on your own with one and you get mocked on sort of on kind of all sides, but we've got each other for some moral support with Sasnovic.
Humiliation loves company. Matt, no other particularly notable results, I don't think. Vondroušová, she won. We don't need to start talking about her just yet, and the fact that we've all completely written her off, and until she reaches the semis or the final, we'll park that. But in terms of news stories, there is one big result from the day today, and that is Kristina Mladenovic winning through 7-5, 6-2 over Hayley Baptiste. Just before we get on to the, you know, less significant news story, wasn't that David's pick for an upset today, Hayley Baptiste? Or was it, no, hang on, was it yours?
That was mine, yes.
Oh no. That was a genuine error. I wasn't passive aggressively trying to set you up for a fall there. But I've
done it. It's all right, because we've all fallen with our daily predictions. Yes. Back with a bang, 0 out of 3.
Luckily, though, events were so sort of dramatic in the aftermath of that match that the world didn't notice Matt Roberts' poor prediction. Because, straight sets win for Mladenovic. She lets out this guttural scream on match point, really sort of animalistic roar that I'm not sure I've ever heard from her before. And then she does this socially distanced on-court interview afterwards where she's asked a pretty innocuous question about what the win means to her. And she sort of starts off by saying, well, yeah, it means a lot. The last 2 days have been awful. I don't know how much I can say. I can't say very much about it. But then she goes on to say quite a lot. She says she's in a bubble within a bubble because she is one of those players who has had contact with Benoit Paire over the course of the last week. And the way the USTA is now dealing with that as a result of the contact tracing they've done, rather than immediately remove those players who are deemed to have had close contact with someone who's tested positive from the draw, they've elected instead to create bubbles within bubbles. And that seems to be the situation that Mladenovic is in. She was asked what she's now able to do from her bubble within a bubble within a bubble within a bubble. And she said, play my matches and nothing else. Pretty much. And we understand that there are 11 players in this situation, and that's not been confirmed by the USTA. There's a whole lot of speculation about who those are. Zverev said in a Eurosport interview that one of those players was Medvedev. That seems to not be true at all. it's a bit of a circus surrounding it all, isn't it?
It is. It's understood that Edouard Roger Vasselin, Richard Gasquet, Grégoire Barrère and Adrienne Mannarino...
Oh, it's not a good time to be French.
It's not. They've all been playing cards, apparently.
This is really showing up the cliqueiness of the French players.
Yes, they only hang out with other French players. Yeah. And it's a really, really bad time to have been at that card table. Are we believing they were playing cards?
It's sort of very quaint, isn't it?
Yes. but Edouard Roger Vasselin gave some more details about sort of what they can and can't do. They obviously now have to all eat in their rooms. They're tested every morning now. They're not allowed to use the lift. They're taken in cars back and forth from the hotel to the courts rather than the buses. And if, like Roger Vasselin, you play doubles, you're obviously not allowed to see your doubles partner apart from when you're on the court. Now, there is a school of thought, I think, that, and I know Greg Wozetsky was saying this on the Prime coverage, that the USTA deserve kind of praise for this in terms of getting the players on the court. I feel a little differently, and I feel it's actually quite problematic that this is happening, sort of relaxing the protocol just seemingly because it affects more than one or two people.
I share the same concerns. It definitely is a deviation from the protocol as we understood it. Yeah, I certainly have outstanding concerns about exactly why that has happened. And as you say, it certainly looks on the surface like it's because it affects an inconveniently large number of players. And the second concern I have that remains unanswered is why, despite any outcome of testing, why Benoit Paire didn't have to self-isolate while he was showing symptoms. Because I've gone back and watched the footage of his retirement from that Bournet-Chorich match. And those were, okay, they could have been symptoms of something other than COVID, but they were definitely symptoms similar enough to COVID symptoms or indicative enough of COVID that you shouldn't need a protocol to tell you to do something. As far as I'm concerned, it's your sort of social moral responsibility as an adult at the moment to follow the advice which is out there, which is that if you exhibit those sorts of symptoms, you should be self-isolating. So the fact that all of these extremely social sounding card games were happening and all sorts of other stuff after he exhibited those symptoms. I mean, he could have been my best friend and I wouldn't have gone near him after that Bournet-Chorich match a week ago. So that alarms me somewhat. But I just keep my fingers and toes crossed that it is contained and they have got lucky with this, because you know, it's possible, you know, as we've seen with Benoit Paire, that we won't know for some time. So yeah, a developing situation. None of these stories are going away. Yeah, and in the midst of it, Stefanos Tsitsipas will continue talking about towels, I'm sure. Matt, before I leave you in the capable hands of David Law, how's the caravan?
Chilly. I haven't quite got to grips with the heating system. But other than that, well equipped and nice. And I was concerned that the internet might not be up to multiple streams and Zoom calls, but all fine on that front. So yes, fine. I feel a little bit like I'm on holiday. It's a little bit lonely and it's a little bit chilly, as I said, but I'm in and it's fine. And I'm not disturbing my parents, which was the aim of the whole thing.
Yes. And you've got a multi-screening setup going on in the caravan?
I have, yes. I've sort of moved a lot of things about and I've managed to set up three screens. So we're all set.
Photos to follow, folks. Follow us on social media if you wish for photos of the what we're modestly calling a caravan, but is actually a sort of luxurious palatial bachelor pad that Matt's got three screens going on. It sounds great, doesn't it? What sounds less great now, Matt, is the fact that you've got to wait for the conclusion of Kyle Edmund and Alexander Bublik, which looks like it's entering a third set tiebreak. All I can say is this was your idea.
Which makes it even worse.
Take a deep breath and remember it's tennis. And we thought we might not get tennis this year. And on that note...
Don't guilt trip me like that.
I'm going to go to sleep. I'm going to leave you, Matt, and the listeners with David Law.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot. We charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hello, Tennis Podcast listeners. David here. Now, you might know that I love a bit of cooking, and I think I'm quite good at it. But if I'm honest, even I get fed up trying to work out what to do every night. That's where Home Chef comes in. Being able to put together a delicious meal without the long prep and the cook times, well, that's pretty cool. Home Chef provides fresh ingredients and chef-designed recipes conveniently delivered to your doorstep to simplify your cooking experience. They have over 30 options a week and serve a variety of dietary needs, so you don't have to worry about what to make ahead of time. Not only is it convenient, but it's economical too. Home Chef customers save an average of $86 per month on groceries. Now, for a limited time, Home Chef is offering Tennis Podcast listeners 18 free meals plus free dessert for life and, of course, free shipping on your very first box. Go to homechef.com/tennis. That's homechef.com/tennis for 18 free meals and free dessert for life. You heard it right. Well, thank you very much, Catherine. I've most enjoyed listening to that. And now I've also very much enjoyed commentating on Kyle Edmund, who has eventually been victorious against the bizarre Mr. Alexander Bublik. 7-5 in the third set, and then he raced through the fourth set when, frankly, Bublik had just had enough. And Bublik threw it away. He hit three double faults in a single game to squander his advantage in the third set. All very entertaining. But, you know, don't put your mortgage on Alexander Bublik coming through for you is all I can say. And actually, to be fair to Kyle Edmund, he's bulked himself up during the lockdown period. He looks strong. He looks fit. He was a worthy winner in the end. I think it was 2-6, 7-5, 7-5, maybe 6-1 in the fourth. I can't exactly remember. And now he plays Novak Djokovic because Djokovic has found a way. Well, I say found a way past Damir Djuma. It was one-sided. It was 6-1, 6-4, 6-1. Second set, actually, there were some great games. There were two games that were more than 10 minutes long each. But it felt, Matt, I know you didn't get a chance to see this because you've been editing the first part of the show, but it felt like Djokovic was almost using him as a bit of a sparring partner to me in the second set. Djuma played very well. He's a good player. He's compact. He's got slice. He's got lovely guile and touch. But it just allowed Djokovic to just work these rallies, you know, and get used to the surroundings of this cavernous Arthur Ashe Stadium with its the various messages that are draped over the seats in place of fans, and, you know, just get his eye in. And I think that couldn't have been a better first round draw for him in many ways, you know what I mean, rather than a big hitter.
I think it's absolutely perfect for Djokovic in round one, Damir Djuma. And in a match like that, you kind of see what Djokovic has in his repertoire sometimes, because he can open his shoulders and he can be a very creative player on the court, and he can maneuver people around the court. I think there's sometimes a description of Djokovic as a bit of a backboard, but he's absolutely not that. He's got so much in his game, and when he comes up against someone like Djuma, he can really express himself and really play himself into form. And I think it's the perfect opening match. And to be honest, I think Edmund's got a lot more weapons than Demir Djuma, but I actually think a second round match against Kyle Edmund is also pretty good for Novak Djokovic.
I mean, he has got one win over Djokovic as Edmund, but that was in Madrid. It doesn't feel like the same sort of thing. I would say, in a way, the bigger hope for Edmund is the match they played at Wimbledon, I think, a year and a half ago, 2 years ago, where Edmund won the first set and was rocking Djokovic with his power. He was really going after the forehand. He was bullying him for a while. But Djokovic has the most amazing ability to just put the ball where you don't want it to be and to put it deep and to diffuse your power. He diffuses power better than anybody in the game, and the men's game anyway. And I think when you talk about people used to call him a human backboard, I would say that I would probably be guilty of that in his early career. But my mind always goes back to Todd Martin when he worked with Djokovic. He told me that Novak likes nothing more than to rest on his laurels. And what that means is to rest on the fact that his movement is so incredible, it can get him out of trouble. And he's so much more than that now. He's completely overhauled his game over the last 10 to 15 years. If you look at the various stages he's gone through, whether it's Boris Becker coming in and coaching him and giving him a different way of going about things, and several other coaches, as you rightly say, he can take on a baseliner and beat them in so many different ways. He always used to have a great drop shot when he first came out onto the circuit, but he was overly indulgent with it. Now it's just all very cleverly utilised to maximum effect. But I am interested to see. I mean, Edmund, I think if he played well, could... I don't think... I'd be surprised if he won a set, but I think he could get a break of serve. I think he could stay with him. I think he could hurt him in pockets, because he does have a forehand that can take the game away from you. But I think if he gets a set, he'll be doing really well.
Yeah, I always think of that Edmund match at Wimbledon that you mentioned as the match which brought out Novak Djokovic, the real Novak Djokovic, once again, because it was around that time that he had been slumping, wasn't it? And he'd had a good run at Queens. He'd reached the final and lost to Marin Cilic. But it was that when he was down against Kyle Edmund in that Wimbledon match, and suddenly he found that resilience and that defiance on the court again, which had been missing for so long. He'd been a kind of vacuum of a man on the tennis court for a couple of years, and he really had to raise his game against Kyle Edmund on that day, I remember. But kind of since then, he's been carrying this wave of confidence and incredible results, and I just think he's playing at a level which will be too high for most people in this draw to touch, and unfortunately for Kyle Edmund, I think too much for him as well.
God, it's been a long cold day today, hasn't it, for us at the tennis? I mean, you know, day one, they happened to schedule three back-to-back men's matches on court five, and we were doing on BBC Radio, we were doing the Cameron Norrie match and then the Kyle Edmund match with Taylor Fritz in between. And somehow, obviously, Norrie went five sets, and then Kyle Edmund's gone four sets, two of them 7-5, and we've had Taylor Fritz in the middle somehow managing to lose a set against somebody you really shouldn't have been losing a set against. So that has meant that we are sitting here at 3:15 in the morning here in the UK with Naomi Osaka at the moment. She's got a break of serve in her match against Masaki Doi. And I noticed Naomi Osaka came out onto the court wearing a mask that had the name Breonna Taylor written on it, which again is another statement of social justice that she is trying to further with every passing day, it seems, and fair play to Naomi Osaka for that. Not sure how the hamstring is, but she's 4-2 up in the first set, so that sounds like it's going well so far. So, tomorrow, Andy Murray is playing a Grand Slam match for the first time in nearly 2 years. It was the Australian Open, wasn't it, when he played against Roberto Bautista Agut. We thought it was the final Grand Slam match that we would ever see him play. And he gave his pre-tournament press conference here a couple of days ago. And there were some really revealing, quite moving moments in that press conference when he was asked by the British media to explain how he's felt at various points over the last couple of years and whether he ever thought he would see this day. And he said, it kind of depends when you asked me that. If you'd have asked me that at various points over the last 18 months, I mean, we've obviously all seen the Amazon Prime Video documentary resurfacing, and you can tell there that there are definitely moments since then, and I think even after his restart when he won the title in Antwerp, when he really did wonder whether he would see this day. And here he is. It's an amazing achievement in itself. And my favourite bit of the press conference was Stu Fraser from The Times asking him if there was anybody that he had sort of taken inspiration from over the course of the last couple of years when he was trying to come back. And I think Stu actually said, maybe a fellow athlete that you might have been in touch with and confided in or taken some inspiration from. And Murray took a few seconds to think about this, and then he said, well, actually, there is somebody who's been an inspiration to me, and it's a surgeon that when I first got my injury in 2017, my hip injury, and I was getting consultancy about it, he said to me, your only chance to get this right is to have hip resurfacing or a hip replacement, but you'll never play tennis again. And I thought to myself, oh, okay. We'll see about that. And then 2 years later, when he had the hip resurfacing, he said, I happened to bump into this surgeon when I was in the hospital the morning after the surgery, and he said, I saw the doctor, just we sort of our eyes met, and he kind of smiled at me, and he said to my wife, I told him this would happen. And Murray said, and he sounded a bit smug to me, and a bit pleased with himself about it, as though, you know, and I thought, I don't like that, and I'm going to go and prove him wrong. and it's just classic Murray, isn't it? It's almost a little bit like The Last Dance with Michael Jordan, finding something to just give him that extra edge. And he said, you know, I have considered sending him a bottle of wine now that I'm back out on the court. And you know, when I managed to make my comeback and win Antwerp, I did consider that. I haven't done it yet, but it's just another classic example of how Andy Murray ticks, isn't it?
Yeah, do not tell Andy Murray no, because he will just go out there and prove you wrong. He's spent a career doing that on the tennis court, and this is a wonderful example of him just getting a little hook of motivation and using it to fuel himself. Yeah, it was a great tale. I don't think he needs to send the bottle of wine. I think he's said all that needs to be said. I'm sure word has reached that surgeon, and he is sort of quaking having been called out and heard that story, I'm sure.
Yoshihito Nishioka is the opponent of Andy Murray, and that match is going to be played at 5 p.m. In the UK, so it's midday local time in New York. That's the first match on the Arthur Ashe Stadium tomorrow. Nishioka is the player that beat Dan Evans in the Australian Open this year. Good player, bit of a ball machine. I think he could make it quite competitive actually. I think Murray's going to have to play well if Nishioka plays well.
Yeah, it's going to be a real test of Murray's stamina and endurance, I think, over five sets. Obviously, this being his first Grand Slam match, as you've said, since January 2019. It's his first five-set match since then as well. Nishioka himself has had lots of injury problems, hasn't he? I remember he did his knee, I think, a couple of years ago and was out for a lengthy period of time as well, and has been steadily making a comeback. But he's quite an exciting player to watch. Left-handed, as you said, incredible foot speed, and I think that one could have some very, very lengthy and sort of interesting rallies as they move each other about the court. That'll be a good one to watch. That
Joe Konta is playing against Heather Watson in their first ever meeting at a Grand Slam tournament. So the two British players that are in the draw, in the women's draw, facing each other. So let's look at it on the positive side from a British perspective. There's going to be a player in the round two. Konta has won their three previous meetings, although one was a retirement. The other two in Nottingham on grass and in Indian Wells on hard court over the last two or three years, both in straight sets. If she plays like she did last week, she's going to win, isn't she?
I think so. She was so impressive in the Western and Southern Open, striking the ball with such conviction and just at a level above what Heather Watson is capable of, I think. Hasn't Heather Watson never won a match at the US Open in the seniors, which is one of those really curious facts, given that she won the juniors here. You would think that was indicative of her liking the conditions, but clearly not. I think Konta starts as quite a strong favourite in that match.
And Konta also gave a press conference. I interviewed her as well. She was saying that she thinks it's going to be a long time before the two tours will properly merge. She said, "I don't think it'll happen during my career." But one answer that I was really quite jolted by was, she was asked about, again by Stu Fraser, about the Battle of the Brits that she took part in, and the moment when she played a couple of days, and then after the final, in the presentation, she wasn't there, and her own teammates brought out a cardboard cutout of her, a big photograph, and the point was made that it felt like they were kind of mocking her a little bit, the fact that she wasn't there as a teammate to cheer them on, etc. She said in this interview that, "Look, you know, I actually signed up to this thing for 2 days, and nobody seemed to tell my teammates that that's what I'd agreed to play, and the rest of the time I was practicing in my own time as I'd agreed to." And I got the sense she was quite hurt by that, to be honest, and she speaks quite warmly of Heather Watson as being the British player that she gets on with best, or that she speaks to quite a lot. And I did feel a bit for Konta in that regard. I mean, I know she's she's not a sociable type, I don't think, with the other players necessarily, but that's kind of her call. I mean, she's her own person, She, her words were, "I think that perhaps reflects more on them than it does on me," which was quite a pointed line, really. It's good to see her at least playing good tennis again, and we'll see how she gets on against Watson tomorrow. After that, Dan Evans is taking to the court. Who's Dan Evans got in the first round?
He's got Sabot Wild, I think. Is that how you say his name?
Yes, who had the excellent win at the end of last or earlier this year. He played in the final tournament, I think, didn't he, before lockdown or something like that?
Yeah, Rio, perhaps.
One of the final ones. Yeah, that's it. On clay, he looked a good player, actually.
Yeah, I think he's more of a clay court, sort of slow court player. I mean, all the talk we're hearing is that the courts in New York are playing reasonably fast this year, certainly compared to other years. And I think those conditions will favour Dan Evans in that matchup.
He is also, as I recall, he was the first player, I think, to contract COVID-19. I remember him coming out and giving a video message about that. So hopefully he's made a full recovery. But Evans, you would think, is going to go into that match as the favourite. So let's just have a quick look at the rest of the schedule for day two. We've got, starting things off after Andy Murray, it's going to be Serena Williams against Christiane, who had such a good run last year, but that's a tough old first-round draw for her. Evening session on Arthur Ashe Stadium, it's Venus Williams against Karolina Muchová of the Czech Republic, who's the 20th seed. That could be a very good match. Then it's Federico Del Bonis against Daniil Medvedev, the third seed. Louis Armstrong Court, Muguruza starts things off against Nao Hubino. Dominic Thiem against Munar of Spain. It's Jaume, isn't it? Jaume Munar.
Yes,
And
exactly.
Then it is Sofia Kenin against Janina Wickmeyer. Madison Keys in the evening session. Grigor Dimitrov against Tommy Paul. Yeah, there are a lot of good matches on the three main courts tomorrow. A lot of big names. Raonic playing as well. Ogier Aliassime, Sloane Stephens, Matteo Berrettini. And then court five for the Brits that I mentioned with Contour against Watson. That match second on after another women's match between Mertens and Sigmund. So probably around about 6 p.m. British time, you would think that would be on, but a bit of a shame that it clashes with Andy Murray from a TV perspective. But on BBC Radio, I think we'll be able to cover that quite well because we'll have commentators on both courts. So looking forward to it. And how about this? Just buried away on court 11, fifth on, Kim Clijsters against Ekaterina Alexandrova. So it really will be so interesting to see how she gets along. So that is tomorrow. Also wanted to just mention that on September the 1st, which is now officially today, a book is being released about Pete Sampras by one of our contributors to the Althea Gibson and Arthur Ashe documentary podcast that we put out last week. And that's Steve Flink, who's been in the game for so many years and one of the great historians of the sport, great journalist, great writer. And he's done this book with Pete Sampras. He's done a lot of interviews with Pete. It's called Greatness Revisited. And he's also interviewed Novak Djokovic, who idolized Sampras in his formative years, and lots of the players that played against Sampras as well. And personally, I can't wait to have a read of that. And I wanted to give it a mention because Steve is one of the good guys of the tennis world. And I'm sure that that book really will be something. And I think it's available now, in fact, as we speak, on Amazon. So if you'd like to have a read of that, go and have a look for Steve Flink's book on Pete Sampras, Greatness Revisited. So I think that's it for one night, isn't it, Matt?
I think it is, David. What time did you start
just
your day?
3:30 in the morning. Well, I think I had to drive up to Manchester from where I live, and I left home at about 11 this morning, and I've obviously had to pack before then. I've had to see the kids before then. So, yeah, I think we're edging towards 22 hours so far that the day has been old for me. But I've loved every minute of it. We'll do it all again tomorrow. Catherine will be presenting on Amazon Prime Video. I was watching her earlier today. She was doing a great job. Don't tell her I said that. And I will be commentating on BBC Radio from 5 p.m. UK time with Andy Murray's match against Yoshihito Nishioka. So looking forward to all that in day two. Then we'll be doing another tennis podcast at the end of the day. Thanks for joining us for this one. If you've enjoyed it, do tell your friends. If you can think of anybody that you reckon might like this show, do pass it on to somebody else. Leave us a review on iTunes if you haven't already. It all helps to spread the word for us. Much appreciated. If you want to get chatting to fellow listeners, we've got a subreddit on the Reddit website, which you can look up the Tennis Podcast and chat with some friends on there. And we've got all the links in our show notes for all these things if you want to check out the details of the things, our social media channels that we're associated with. But thanks for listening to this one. We'll be back again with you tomorrow, and speak to you then.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey, marketers. Want a matchmaker to set you up with your perfect audience? Well, look no further. Get intimate right away with host-read sponsorships with Acast. Use Acast's self-serve ad platform to search and partner up with a podcaster or two from our network of more than 100,000 shows. Have them sing your praises in their own words. And get their listeners ready to be wooed into loyal customers. It's the ultimate loving endorsement. Book host-read sponsorships with Acast. Head to go.acast.com/closer to get started.